But well, I think it'd be best at any phases of life or anything to get, at least to get started in the conversation if you start with, with any questions.
I would like to start at the beginning and
well, about where I was born.
About your genealogy and where you came from and about your parents and so forth. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's good.
Well, why don't, rather than I ask you a question, why don't you just tell me something about your genealogy?
Well, of course, I was born over here in Clark County, Indiana, between Henryville and Otisco. I'm a 1890 model, September the 9th, 1890. My mother was a Dunleavy. That's a quite a well-noted family in Clark County. And my father was Wilbert Sanders, a farmer. But Papa died when he was quite young. He was only 29 years old when he died. He bumped his knee on a ladder going up in the hayloft. And tuberculosis of the bone set up in that, and it eventually caused his death. But I was 5 years old when Papa died, and my little brother was three, and my sister was born some couple of months after Papa died. So that left me to be raised on a poor Indiana farm over there in Clark County, who had 80 acres, I believe it was, at that time. And Mom always fed a couple of pigs off. One would be for her own meat, the other would be to sell, of course. And she sharecropped the farm out. She didn't have any facilities for farming herself. But I think for the first year and a half after Papa died, we lived out of Blue Lick, Indiana, with my grandpa Dunleavy, Thomas Dunleavy. And not the young Thomas, the auctioneer, but I guess it was named after Grandpa. And we just lived a normal life. I went to the Oakland Schoolhouse. That's a one-room school. It was about 2 miles from where we lived. Of course, we didn't have school buses in those days. We trudged it through the mud and snow and weather, whatever it was. And just got to, might say, just a one-room schoolhouse education. In fact, Mom got married, a second marriage, when I was 12 years old. And she married a gardener, farmer from up in Greenwood, Indiana. And so then we went to Greenwood. But this guy didn't like stepchildren, so I didn't last too long at home. And I went to work for farmers. I worked for a farmer named Tex. I could work in the wintertime and done what milking and feeding and things like that before school time, like a lot of country boys would.
You were telling me about working for Tex.
Yeah, I worked for an old German farmer named John Tex. And, of course, by getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, we had always got our milking and feeding done and by the time school time. But that winter, I was promoted to the 7th grade. At the start of school. I'd finished the 6th grade and went in for 2 weeks. I went to school that winter, and I never could, they'd started algebra, you know. And there's some of the alphabet. I don't remember much about it now, but I know X equals the unknown quantity, but I never could get figures and alphabet to mix. So I just quit school, so unfortunately. So being a 6th grade dropout, well, my life has been rather unintellectual, and have done a lot of hard work all my days. So then I went down, the next year I went down to southern Indiana in Washington County and worked for a farmer again. I worked on the farm for the next, I was 15 years old. When I left the farm, went to New Albany. I had an uncle who was a motorman on the city streetcars there, so he got me a job as a collector or conductor, I think they called him, on the streetcars. So I was on that job when my 16th birthday came along, and few days after that, well, some gentleman come from down to Jeffersonville, all rode my, made connection with my run on the, he rode the interurban from Jeffersonville to New Albany, and made connection with my run there. He asked me that night, would I like to go to Cuba, volunteer for 1 year in the Army? I said, well, I'm only 16 years old, just a few days ago. He says, you're big enough. He says, tell them you're 21. Just go up there, gentlemen, tell them you're 21. He says, they'll take you. Well, I went up the next morning. Sure enough, they did take me. Of course, I get $30 a month there. I never wasn't making that much on the streetcar. I think they only paid us about $15, $20. Just little nothing. So I went to Cuba then that winter. That was because we were during the American intervention there, I mean, of peacekeeping during the election. Whichever party was in was going to throw the other one out, whichever the election went. It was the BFO. And of course, we, Cuba being a protectorate of ours, I had Uncle Sam to keep things smooth. So I was put in the winter over there. About the last of February, they posted a bulletin for any of the volunteers that wished to, for discharge, would be eligible to get it. So I was homesick as a dickens, so I applied for my discharge. And I come back to Alabama because my mom at that time, she and her husband had sold out up in that country and moved to Texas. I don't remember what town it was in Texas now. So I came back to Alabama then, where my uncle, another uncle, my mother's sister's husband, was an engineer on the railroad there, so he got me a job at the railroad company. I got a job as a striker in the blacksmith shop. And that was quite a heavy job for a youngster, but anyhow, I held it down till something else showed up that he thought was better for me. And that was down at Jasper, Alabama, at the other end of the division. So I went down to Jasper and doodling ashes out there, cleaning ice pans on the locomotives after the previous day's run, getting them ready for the next day and filling the sand boxes, you see. One morning, a fireman didn't show up for his run, and so I told the engineer, I said, I can fire this thing all right for you. So he took me out on that run with him. Well, I did so well that when I came back in, why, he asked for me as a regular fireman on the job. So Mom signed a miner's release for me. I was about 16 and a half years old then, you see. And I went to fire, and I fired there for 5 years and 12 days, I believe it was, before I finally got fired. Of course, that would seem to be in my category, my way of life. I'd gotten fired off of the first job. I skipped that part. Mom hired me out, let me work for a farmer down out about 2 miles from our farm. He would pay me $2 a month and my board. So I worked for him that first month, by Joe, and he fired me. Sent me home, said he wouldn't feed me for me. So when I went home and told my mom that Mr. Norris had fired me, and here was the $2 I got for the month's work. You see, he put me back in the woods clearing new ground. And out there in the woods all by myself. Well, Lord gracious, there was squirrels, bluebirds, woodpeckers, and everything going on around there. It, I guess, attracted my attention. And I didn't clear as much ground as he thought that even boy should clear. I know I cleared quite a big patch, as I remember how it was. But anyhow, it wasn't enough to hold my job. Well, Mom gave me a tongue lashing. It's lasted me all my life, even today. It learned me by Job that there was nothing to do, only work. Give the best that you had in you all the time. And when she got through tongue lashing, I felt as low down as a snake's belly. It was just awful. And to think that I'd hurt my mother's feelings in that way, to think that I was so no count, which is that I couldn't hold a job at $2 a month. At least it took the board bill off of her having to do it. You see, she sold for the neighbors as making suits. There wasn't many store-bought clothes back in those days. Usually the men folks bought a suit to get married in, and then that was put away, and that was their shroud when they was put away. And they wore jeans and corduroy pants, and they were usually made by some local seamstress in the neighborhood. So Mom was a good seamstress, so she done the sewing. She made all the boys' school suits for dozens and dozens of them, made the school girls' dresses, and you know, she had a busy season getting towards school season, getting everybody fixed up. So after I got fired on the Southern, I didn't intend to ever build seniority again. I was chairman of the grievance committee of the Brotherhood, and that's what led to my dismissal. My insistence that they put a man back to work that they had fired, according to the company rules, wasn't justified, don't you see? And he wasn't. I had to admit to them, too, that he wasn't the kind of a man that they ought to have, but they hired him. That was up to them, seeing they got me, so he was in the union, so I said, I was the chairman of the grievance committee, it's up to me to prosecute his case. So I didn't intend to ever build seniority again, so I just become a boomer. I'd fire wherever there was heavy work going on. Went to Norfolk and Western in my next job from there. I couldn't leave home, though, right at the time I got fired, because my second baby wouldn't be born for another 30, 40 days. So I come down out of the cab of a passenger engine where I'd been firing there for getting $7 a trip. I went to work on the section the next day in an extra gang, and I got 70 cents a day. And my board, we slept in camp cars on the side of the track. We didn't do it, wasn't regular section hands. We done special work, putting in ties and laying new steel and things of that kind.
Bring us up to date on when you got married and who you married.
Well, that's getting awful close.
Oh, I thought you said that your second baby was born.
Oh. Yes. Well, that's while I was firing. I got married when I was 18 years old. I was making a man's wages. I was keeping a mother and sister and had my own home and everything. So I thought I'd just have a wife same as anybody else. And I married a girl there in Jasper. And we had three children. Two girls and a boy.
You were firing.
Well, I was a boomer farmer, but anyhow, I got a little ambition to try to do something better out of myself. I thought that I could be another Clarence Darrow. He was one of the leading lawyers of that day, you know, and I admired him, and I didn't see why I couldn't learn be a lawyer as good as he could. So I went studying law through the LaSalle Extension University. Had a family, you see, I couldn't go to no law school, so. I studied law and correspondence and kept that up for about 3 years. And as I boomed around to different jobs, I went from the Norfolk and Western, where we were on a coal haul from Roanoke to Cruz. We were shipping a lot of coal to England, to Europe. When that rush was over and couldn't get much overtime, well, then I come back to Tennessee for the Illinois Central. I worked there during their fruit rush, and I then lingered on for about a year before anything else showed up. Then I went to the Rock Island out of Little Rock, where they were double tracking their tracks, so that meant there's a lot of stone to be hauled. They got on a lot of extra crews, and I get a lot of work there. I just trying to flag by, you know, till I get to be a lawyer. That's where they earn a living. Yeah. I went out to Little Rock. There's where I quit the road altogether. They had a wreck on the Hot Springs Special down at Duval's Bluff. That's why I was firing an engine out of Brinkley at that time. And on a passenger run to Newport. And the train was so late, we couldn't imagine what happened. So after a while, here come a flagman walking in, and they had turned over several cars and heard a lot of the colored coaches had turned over, heard a lot of people. So I thought, well, here's a chance for me to quit railroad. And I got far enough along the law that I could write a power of attorney and do some things that might make me some money extra on the side. So I went to the house, changed clothes, got on my overalls, put on my suit, my street clothes, so to speak, come back to the depot, waiting for them to bring in the injured colored folks. The claim agent was working one side of the waiting room, signing them up for a dollar, you know, and turning them loose. And I was working the other side, signing up their case that I'd handled their case before the lawyer. So that gave me my percentage on the cases that I settled for them, gave them more money, and gave me a little bit to go on, too. So then I went into Little Rock and devoted my time altogether to law, studying in the office of Judge Fred A. Isgrig and practicing in the Justice of the Peace Court. You didn't have to be admitted to the bar to practice in J.P. Court. I guess it's cause of no justice there anyway, and we can do it. But I had a tough time there in the J.P. courts. Finally, they being such fee grabbers as they were, the legislature, a bill came before the legislature to, well, they couldn't abolish the office because it's constitutional office, but they could set his fees. So they put him on a salary of $1 a year, abolished the fee system for him, and he could only hold hearings in felony and murder cases, something real serious of that nature. He couldn't have any civil suits, don't you see, garnishes and things that would ordinarily come before a J.P. court. So that cut him out. That cut me out of practicing law. I had a case in Judge Ivory's court. He was about one of the most overbearing birds there was. My client had borrowed some money from a loan shark there, and he had paid over 300% of the loan in interest and still owed the entire loan. But anyhow, he got sued for it and garnished. Well, Arkansas law was, if the debt was void, so far as principal interest both was concerned, if you charge usurious interest, and his rate of interest was exorbitant. So that was my defense, but anyhow, the court ruled against me, just as they usually would. So I went over across the river to fix up bond, and while I was gone, they made my client, or intimidated him, or begged him into signing his check over to the court and making peace with the loan shark and the court, you know, and get through. When I come back ready to take the appeal, why, he had already settled with him. Well, he hadn't paid me my $10, so I filed an attorney's lien against the check before it got to the justice of the peace. So here come the railroad check then, made to myself and T.B. Ivy. Well, the House and Senate was holding a joint hearing in the Capitol Hotel on this bill, a public hearing. And they had old Senator Gore from Oklahoma was their attorney for the J.P.s, and he was very eloquent and made a wonderful plea on their behalf. But he challenged anyone to show where there had ever been a miscarriage of justice in a J.P. court. I thought, well, I've got good evidence that there was one. So if he's still talking when I can get back from office, I'll run over and get that check, and I'll accept his challenge. And I did that. And so they never put on another witness, never heard another thing. So they go back to the legislature and pass the law the next day. Well, I also had a case in court, in Mr. Ivy's court, the next morning. So when I walked in, they had this client of mine there to demand his check. I said, give me my fee and you and Ivy can have your check. And I started then to walk away from him, and he hit me from behind, kind of back over my left shoulder, and almost floored me. I come up, I had a chair to want to crush him down, and then I had about six or eight constables on me. You know how there's always a pack of them in the J.P. court. So there I was then, arrested for assault and battery. Then I had to be tried before one of them. Of course, I swore Ivy off of the bench, and he sent me way up in the other end of the county. I don't know, miles and mud road. There's never been a gravel or nothing. I was just through the woods. Judge Isgrig, who was where I'd been stunned longer, he was my attorney. So we go up there and demanded a jury, of course, of 12 men. Well, he says, I don't think there's 12 men in the neighborhood. He says, I know we can get six. I said, well, if you got them tied out, bring them in and I'll take a look at them. Say, all right, well, I'll tell you. So when he brought the six in, I couldn't see any justice to come out of that woolly-looking bunch because they were his, see. So I asked for another change of venue. And then he put it way down on the other side of the county in the mud and so forth. But anyhow, while they're hammering around to make a convict out of me, why, the legislature, the governor signed the bill. The legislature passed it the next day, abolishing them. So that ended my career as a lawyer. I decided I didn't want any more law or being a lawyer. Maybe I would have never had sense enough to anyhow, but I had a lot of experience there. And from that back, I don't remember what I did next. Oh, yes, I came back up here to Indiana, Louisville. And did you ever hobo?
No.
Didn't you? No, you missed something. Well, I hoboed. Of course, I hoboed earlier in that in life when I'd be going from one railroad job to another. I had my union card. I never did ask a brotherhood man to feed me. I carried some canned goods and things in my suitcase, don't you see? I could always have my own grub without mooching that off of a fellow. But all I ask him for is the privilege of riding in one of the empty gondolas and not be put off and things of that kind. Well, I had a brother down there at Little Rock that had been to the Rock Island, and he was terrible about drinking beer. And he would always drink too much of it. So to get him to come back, like getting back up here in Indiana, away from the crowd that he'd been running with down at Little Rock so long. But he wouldn't come on a train. He was going to ride the rods. Now, he didn't want to ride the blind, but going to ride the rods of a plane. Well, that's extremely dangerous under there, because gravels could hit you so hard, you know. So we laid out there by the deep hole at midnight. Well, done it two nights. The first night was there, I went to sleep before the train come in, and he got up and hiked and left. So then time I hunted him down the next day and got him back on line, and I had him out there on the grass with me that night. We rode the blinds of the Illinois Central, coming into Louisville here. Man, it was a frost, one of these here black frosts, you know, cold as the dickens. When I got off the train there in Louisville, my feet and legs just felt like I was walking on pegs. Well, anyhow, I was back home up here. My mother lived out at Henryville yet then. So the next thing, what was I to do? So I went to work on the section while I was trying to think of something else to do. I've tamped every tie between Sellersburg and Scottsburg, Indiana, on that Pennsylvania Railroad. We worked 10 hours a day. We got 16 cents an hour. That's the same wages I got when I went to firing. I got 16 and a half cents an hour firing an engine for a 12-hour run. So I worked this job for a while, and finally I come to the conclusion, well, I got the same blood in me that these cousins of mine have, these Dunleavy boys around Henryville. They were auctioneers, stock buyers, and farmers, and insurance, and everything like that. Well, I was half Dunleavy, and my mother's a sister to their daddy. So I said, I've got this good blood. If they can make a living with a white collar on, I can too. So I borrowed a suit of clothes. I didn't think mine looked good enough to go to Jeffersonville to try to find a job. But I went down and hit the Prudential for a job, and I was hired immediately. And I was put on a debit that I was the fifth man that had been on that debit that year, just a regular graveyard for anybody going. I didn't know it, of course. But I didn't.
Interrupt a second. That one in your ring. Oh, wait. It picks up on this mic.
I'm sorry about that.
Go ahead.
And I didn't know anything only work, so I wrote insurance like nobody's business on that. Nobody had ever written any insurance, got my collections up good. And 13 months, I was assistant superintendent of the staff. Well, from that, then I went from the ordinary department, from the industrial department to the ordinary department of the Prudential, because they got a higher commission than we got on in the ordinary, in the industrial department. We got 35%, and they got 55%. Then I was doing pretty good, so then I went to W.W. Dennison Company, wrote insurance here for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years in Louisville. And then from that, I got a good guaranteed job where I could make $700-$800 a month working for the Michelin Tire Company. And I moved to Winchester, Kentucky, and started down there then. And I come into Kentucky and lived here several years. Bridge fell with me there as I was coming from my home across Hickman Creek. They had a cable bridge, so the cable broke 3 days before Thanksgiving, frosty morning. That eye of the rod snapped, you know, and my car just dropped head down, just like you drop the tailgate of a wagon. I was pulling my brother, my son's car, to get a school car, to get them started before I went out on the road. I just had a motor job done on it and be kind of stiff, you see, afraid it wouldn't start. Both of our cars went down. I fell 42 foot head down. He fell about 35 foot. I went down over the bank in the edge of the water. And that ended then my work with the Michelin Tire Company. Then I went in the service station business at Nicholasville. I hitchhiked into Lowell to try to find a job. And I was out about St. Matthew somewhere on the road, and a gentleman picked me up in a nice big car, and it happened to be Mr. Gardner, who was state manager for the Standard Oil Company. And, of course, that gave him a chance to talk with me. At least, I mean, he just picking to see who he had and what he had. So his station in Nicholasville, the fellow there, they had a lovely location there on the corner. And this fellow, Dick's Lake had just opened up, so he went into boating and fishing, him and all the sportsmen of Nicholasville, so he turned his service station more, and the gasoline went to the dogs, so they were going to get rid of him. So, you know, one day I got a call from Mr. Gardner. Instead of giving him 30, he did give him 30 days notice that he'd have to cancel the station. Instead of him staying the 30 days, I think he only stayed about 10 days, 2 weeks longer. And not enough to get all of his friends to boycott the station, you see, because they killing their leading sportsmen in town, their boatman and all. So I took that station over. I know the first day I had a car, you passed there like it was a pest house. There wasn't nobody coming by. I sold 3.5 gallons of gas. Well, that looked like starvation to me, but I kept it up. It wasn't no time till I had the station built up, the biggest station they had in Kentucky.
About what year was that?
I believe that was about 1924, 5, somewhere along there. So I run that station for quite a while until I went down to Nicholasville. Not Nicholasville, I was in Nicholasville. I went down to Corbin. The Shell Oil Company made me a bid. They'd build me a station down there and charge me no rent and would build living quarters in connection with the station. Now, quite naturally, that sounded like a good proposition. Then I went in at Nicholasville on that road. I'd say after supper time was over with and nothing on the road, you know, no travel. But I wanted to be on a highway where there's travel 24 hours a day if I could. So on the route US 25 to Florida, it looked like a good bet for me. So I went down there, and that's how come we go to Corbin. And I'd credited out my gasoline and my garage work there at Nicholasville. Wasn't much. I had over $6,000 out on the book and couldn't collect a dime of it, you know, because we had that terrible drought. The farmers didn't have any money. They sold sheep for 50 cents a head that they'd paid $22 a head for. Just wasn't any water. The town itself hauled railroad tank cars from Louisville here for water for the town. So it was just a real panic there. So I you might say I went broke. So I had to take my grease rack up that I had paid $400-some-odd for, took it up out of the ground, and sold it for enough to finish paying a month's rent. And I thought, well, my gracious, if I got to go to sell my equipment to pay rent, what the dickens you staying here? I won't have nothing. My equipment was all paid for. So then I went to, I just pulled everything up and went to Corbin, took advantage of these people's offer, don't see, to build me that station. So that's how I come down the mountains. And from that, I started in a little lunchroom, and then my Will Rogers made the statement at that time that life begins at 40. Well, I was then, I think, 40 years old. So I thought, well, it's time for me to look into things. What do I want anything I've done in the past? I couldn't see where I could go back and elaborate on it and build on it for the future. And I was selling a lot of gasoline. That's something I know people are going to have if they had to sell their mother-in-law's chickens. They'd buy gas. They wouldn't buy gas. They had a car. And they're going to eat if they had they may not eat today, but they're going to have to eat sometime next 2 or 3 days. Maybe I get that. So I decided on the food and the gasoline business is the thing that I'd say with.
What was the size of your first restaurant, and how'd you get it started?
It's a shame to call it a restaurant. There was one room in that service station. I had an oil room for the oil barrel and thing, and the other front room, nothing was in it at all. I didn't have any money to buy anything with. Shell Oil Company furnished me the paint to paint road signs, and I hired a sign man who was willing to paint for his food that he got, don't you see? So he, with the family, he painted it. So we went out and went painting barns, and business went to picking up. So we had a lovely business, but I had this 15-foot room. And as soon as I'd been there about 30 days, I think people knew I was in town. Some of them did, and I could get credit for some covering for that floor. So I bought a $16 congolium rug. Remember these old stiff congolium rugs that shine like the dickens and had pretty flowers in them? Well, I covered that floor, and I wheeled out the old family dining room table and the six chairs. and we'd cook for the family of five of us, three children, my wife and self. That'd be at 11 o'clock. We tried to have dinner ready, because that was a Cincinnati time, and my people going south, you see, it was dinner time for them at 12 o'clock when it was 11 with us. Sometimes we'd sell out one of the meals, sometimes we'd sell them all, and maybe someday we wouldn't sell any. But I sat down, truck driver, I didn't know a thing in the world about the restaurant business. I Talbot O'Holt and all the cart and all that stuff didn't mean a thing in the world to me. I never heard of it, because as a railroad man, we just ate in railroad lunchrooms, don't you see? So I fed truck driver and millionaire, old Dr. Sloan. He ate with me for some 5 or 6 years after I did get to going, because I'd sit him down at the table with some truck driver. He was a surgeon from Mayo's Clinic, and come through this way going to Florida. So I fed him there, but of course he ate our good old family home-cooked grub, don't you see, we had for ourselves. And he enjoyed it, and he come back every year. He says, I just want to see what the thunder you're doing next year. So I only stayed on that side of the road. I was on the inside the curve. And my competitor was a Gulf Oil Company across the street. He was on the outside the curve, so for half a mile up the road, it looked like his station was sitting right in the road, so people could make up their mind. In order to get gas, they had to run that gas station. When we put in my station, the city went putting the natural gas out there, and when they pushed the gas line across to get on the other side of the road, I had them push a small pipe over from my air tank, so I could let him have air off of my tank. I had the only air tank out in that part of town, so that pleased him so to think that he could air tires and do things that he never had been able to do before. That when he got ready to quit business, he offered me that station of his, so I bought it, and that's where Sanders Court and Cafe was built, then on the other side of the road. I moved over there. Still didn't know anything about the food business other than just cook home food. But I did build me three homemade tables. I was telling a fellow about them yesterday. They had 4-inch oak legs to them, and I painted the table frame. The part that was all painted green, with trellis green. I don't know how I happen to like green. But I had a floor covering on that floor, too. Painted the table not green, and the painted masonite board. They just come out. It's the first lease I'd ever seen, so I could make a whole tabletop out of one nice smooth board. So I made the top of the table, and I painted them orange, about the color of these chairs we're sitting in now. Wouldn't it be nice to sit down at a table with green legs and orange top that you eat dinner?
Bright orange, too.
But I had another fancy. I loved orchid. So my kitchen, all the woodwork and things in the kitchen was painted orchid. Huge orchid enamel. I bought the orchid from a high-class paint company here in Louisville. They had a beautiful color, a beautiful shade. So I had a real fancy restaurant then. I had three homemade tables and the big round table that I had. And he had a lunch counter. Lunch counter was about 3.5, 4 feet high. He stood up, made off of it, you see. Well, that didn't last too long. It didn't amount to a whole lot, but my tables went pretty good. And from that time on, Duncan Hines listed me in Ventures of Good Eating, bless your heart. And so people got coming in there that amounted to something. And then the truck drivers, they found me. I kept them until they finally, I had to run them away. You know, they always picked up a bunch of bums and girls from up in the mountain, right, to ride with them a piece, so they come in, they just take a place over. So I had to get rid of the trucks, and then my business started with passenger cars. And it just grew and grew. It wasn't long until I had to get out of drop the gasoline business, because my food business had got to be the most important part of it. So it goes way back to my childhood days when I was 6 or 7 years old, cooking for Mom, you see, while she was sewing. She'd tell me how to tend to certain things she had on the stove coming, and I did it like she said. And that's where I learned about cooking. And of course, I always a stickler for quality. I know that quality is what built my business, and I'm a stickler for it yet.
Were you cooking fried chicken, or let's say?
Just old home fried in skillets, you know. And cooked chicken like Mom did. She'd Redditor chicken in flour, put on a skillet of fat, you know, the amount of fat that are required, I think about half, three-quarters of an inch deep, so it'd come up on the side of the chicken a piece, and salt and pepper this chicken, and roll it in flour, and then brown it. Cook it slow. It takes about 30, 35 minutes to cook good home fried chicken, southern fried chicken, like the old colored folks used to fix them. You cook it slowly, keep turning, get it nice and brown, then you cover it, and put a little water in the skillet with the fat settled on the back of the stove and let it steam a bit there, and that kind of tenderized the crusting on it, don't you see? And made, oh, it was just simply out of the world. But in a restaurant then, I wanted to have good chicken for my customers in this restaurant I had. By the time I get chicken fried, the customers are gone because they couldn't wait no 30, 35 minutes. They were tourists. And so fried chicken just didn't get over very good with me. It was awful good when I got it if I had somebody to eat it. But I had too much of it to eat myself because the customers just weren't there. But I developed this special seasoning of 11 different spices and herbs that I use now in my... That was in the breading. Instead of just plain salt and pepper, it enhanced the flavor of the chicken, made it so much better. And I just had excellent chicken. Well, then the pressure cookers came out, I believe, in 1939. That's at least the first I knew of them. And I was invited down to a hardware store to see a demonstration of cooking vegetables. They'd cook green beans in 4 minutes, they cooked some other vegetable in 2 minutes, and just as real so fast you couldn't hardly eat. Well, that way I didn't have to cook my food up and hold it on a steam table a long time, so I could keep food coming fresh. So I bought 8 of them. Well, at that particular time, I had a Dutch oven. It's about 18 inches long, a big cast iron Dutch oven, and with a ground joint lid, and I was frying my chicken in that. And I'd put this lid on and put a little water in after it was done, set it on the back of the stove like Mother did, and then set a weight on that. So here I was cooking vegetables under pressure, and I was trying to get just a little pressure in that cooker, you see, to tenderize my chicken. So the thought came to me, well, why can't I adapt one of these cookers to frying chicken? So it's merely a matter of time and temperature and the amount of fat to use. So by the end of the day, I was frying chicken in one of the cookers. Of course, they were so small, I could only fry just a couple of orders of chicken at a time. But that was fine. I fried chicken from the raw to the finished product in 7 minutes. So that was the beginning, really, of Kentucky Fried Chicken. So I used it in my own restaurant there in order to have the best fried chicken anybody in the country had in their restaurants, which it was. Nobody else exceeded by frying under this high compression. The moisture couldn't come out of the meat. So drove all those natural juices and heat right into the bone, cooking, making it tender juicy, and done it in 7 minutes' time. Never thought of ever franchising until they surveyed the interstate system, and then it was to go 7 miles west of Corbin. That'd leave me sitting high and dry there with my restaurant. So then the question was, what could I do now to save out this wreck? I thought, well, everybody has loved my chicken off. Well, chicken and country ham was the main thing. So I went out and started to see if I could get anybody to take franchises. I had a pretty good idea that it could be made to go because there had been a chicken franchise about, 15 years. It's been 35, 40 years ago now. Chicken in the Rough by Beverly Osborne in Oklahoma City. Come on. Well, it was really too rough to be called chicken, but he made $2 million on it. And I thought, well, if he made $2 million on that, surely I can make a living with mine by franchising. So I went out, I thought franchising, of course, I thought everybody had anything to franchise was a shyster because I had had a fellow stick me, a little old man, stuck me on some soft ice cream business. I bought the rights for North and South Carolina. And I lost $16,000 to get down there, found out he didn't have to have any special mix at all. All he'd done just called up me and got 25 cents a gallon on the mix. And see, the man, just by calling I think he called it dairy freeze. And so when I got ready to open, that place, first place I had in North Carolina, well, he said, you don't have to have any special formula. He said, just call the dairy and get all your 5 gallon ice cream mix. I said, you mean tell me that I'm to take 25 cents off of this boy and give you 10 cents of it and make me make 15 cents? I said, I never made what I've got that way, so we're not going any further on that. So I lost that $16,000. I told this boy then, I said, you don't have to pay anybody 25 cents a gallon. You just call up and order your mix. And so he went to it on his own. I come back to Kentucky and step on, of course, in my resting chicken pits. I had that at Bone Good at Corbin. But I had to go to franchising eventually.
Oh, we had plenty of time.
It was slow taking hold. Claudia, my wife, she was my shipping clerk and packaging girl, me packaging the spices and things there at home, and then I'd be on the road trying to sell chicken. But see, I never sold a franchise. I still don't sell a franchise in Canada today. We give the people the franchise given to them, and they pay us just a nickel a head. Down here, they pay $4,000 to $10,000 for a franchise after I sold out while the company has boosted things differently. They get that much for the franchise front money, and then they get as high as 18 cents a head for the chicken by taking 4% of the gross sale on the chicken he's on.
What year do you think you developed your secret recipe?
I went to frying under pressure in 39, but I'd been using the secret recipe of herbs and spices, possibly about 32, 33, back along in there, 5, 6 years.
How exclusive do you believe this recipe really is?
How good?
How exclusive is it, do you believe it is? Can somebody else stumble on?
Maybe not exactly the combination or proportions that I have, but spice people will always see it's been such a leader and created such excitement in the poultry industry that everybody's been trying to get in the chicken business. That's the reason so many went broke here 2 or 3 years ago. They'd get him a celebrity and a promoter take a celebrity's name, and he didn't know how to fry chicken, neither did the celebrity. But anyhow, they'd try to get started. But they have developed seasonings now that are, I'd say, equally as good as mine. And it's just a question of, they don't all handle it the same. And frankly, my chicken today is sold by the company is not what it was when I started. I put in between 500 and 600 franchises myself where we sold out to Brown and Massey.
Colonel Sanders, when did you first become a millionaire?
Oh, I just made a good living part of the time. I made a good living part of the time. I'd been just as low in food and life as anybody in the country. But I become what you'd call a millionaire in 1960, let me see. Yeah, 64 it was. I sold out to Massey and John Brown. I got $2 million for the business. So what I've been telling you covers practically every phase of my life except the ups and downs and the fights that I had and different things of that kind. Anyway.
You did achieve your success later in life.
Yes, a real success, you might say, came to me. Well, then my tax man told me, though, 6 years ago, he said, if you was to die now, he says the government will collect $900,000 in taxes off of you. I said, off of your estate. I said, well, Uncle Sam and I are partners, and I'm in charge of the business. So if the good Lord let me live 3 years, I'll give away his $900,000 and $900,000 of mine. So we had a lot of poor kin folks. We had some employees that their circumstances weren't the best in the world. They were loyal and worthwhile. So we begun giving people $12,000 a year apiece. We could do that without giving a tax. I don't know. It's not a sensible theory in the eyes of business people. Of course, I don't propose to be a businessman. But I don't see any use of being the richest man in the cemetery. You can't do any business in there. And just like with the Canadian company. If I had kept the Canadian company, we valued it at $6 million when I gave it away. So, but Uncle Sam would have reached in. He might have valued it more than $6 million on the basis of what the American company had done in Kentucky Fried Chicken. Then he would have took 53% his inheritance tax. I'd have had to sell the 47% to pay the 53, so the whole thing had been down the drain. So I reasoned it that me and the Canadian boys up there had made that company from scratch. So it should go back to be their baby the rest of their lives. So I gave that whole company, I incorporated the Harlan Sanders Charitable Foundation, and Claudia and I gave the whole thing to charity. And we have, up to this time, we've given over $600,000 in scholarships. We've given thousands and thousands of dollars to crippled children's hospitals and other hospitals and needy people. And the way it works, when a man pays his royalty, he pays royalty just like they did in the States to me, a nickel a head on the chicken. Well, then we take out the operating expenses of the company. We operate all of Canada with just 9 men, so our operating expenses is nothing compared with what they are here. We got several hundred men, people working out here, you see, on chicken. So then after we take the operating expense, then every man then gets his royalty back, less his proportionate part of the expenses. And he is the local businessman that says what charity or what organization will get the money. We write all the checks in Toronto, and we merely send him the check, and then he presents as a rule. He will add an equal amount to it, you see, have him make his own contribution. So it's been a very fine thing all across Canada, and the Canadians like it. Canadians like me for having done it, and I'm just happy. I'd rather have it. Of course, I get a salary. I'm still president of the company up there. And I'm going to have my banquet there this coming Monday night. See, the first day of May it is. No, it's the 30th day of April, isn't it? 30th of April.
Colonel Sanders, do you have a philosophy on life?
Well, I don't know what you call a philosophy. My philosophy of life is to work and keep honorable and be honest above everything else. I think that, and I've always felt this way, that if I can do something for somebody that wants some help or something, if the help to them means so much more than the hurt would to me, I'll strain myself to see that I can help them, you see. And sometimes that turns out to be awfully costly, especially when somebody has heard that you had money, and when you had a little money, you could even write a check for $2,000 or $3,000. I got a preacher out in Kansas. I let him have $3,000 just about a year ago, or signed a note down here at the bank for the $3,000. And now then, I'll have it to pay off. You see, he quit preaching and went to doing something else. Don't know even where he is. But you can help people, and some of them are deserving and some not. The scholarships that I give to the colleges here at Berea, Union College, and Pikeville, and Aurora College in Illinois, the College of the Bible, and Lincoln University in Chicago, in Indianapolis. And then when you get a letter back from them, and say they've found out who their benefactor was. They don't know where the money come from. Find out who their benefactor is. They tell them that I had done it. You know, I get the warmest letters, most appreciative thing, that you don't care a thing in the world about the money. You just think that it meant something. It means somebody so much more to somebody when it's in use like that. It does to me. I have a rule that if you smoke cigarettes or use alcoholic beverages while you're in college, your scholarship's cut off, because I haven't got any money for you to burn. Burn your own. And if you want to learn, why, you can't do it and drink booze, so let that alone. And I hope that I've helped somebody along the way. And the good Lord's been good to me. I might say come under God's protection. About 3 years ago myself, I had a wicked life for cursing. I'd always been a fellow believing in tithing and done all I could in charitable ways and things, but that don't clear your way into heaven at all for after death. So I finally was able to conquer this cursing, and it's been a great life for me. It's been a great life. And I would far rather have had my 83 years or 82 and a half years back of me than to have the next 82 and a half years coming up. I don't know telling what all you're going to hit now. Huh? Time you're 83.
Well, I hope I get that far, and I hope I can be as active as you are.
Well, that's due to taking care of my health. I've never used booze nor cigarettes, and haven't abused myself. I've always worked hard, and work doesn't hurt anybody. In fact, it's good for you.
I was interviewing you in one of the hotels in Louisville one day, and you had a little phrase that you quoted for me that was sort of a philosophy. Do you recall that? It was a little rhyme that sort of, I think, I more or less was, I thought was your philosophy.
The hard way, I guess.
I think that was it, yeah.
Probably so.
I don't know. Recall that?
Let me see.
If you don't, that's okay. I thought maybe...
No, I can't recall right now.
Yeah, I don't recall exactly what it was.
Oh, it's comparatively easy to prosper by trickery and the oppression of the weak, violation of confidence.
I believe that's what it was.
Yes. I can't give you the words to it, not just exactly like it was.
Well, listen, let me wrap this up. Colonel Sanders, thank you so much for talking to me.
It's been a pleasure. If it means anything to you or anybody else, God bless you.
Thank you.